And right there, dear listeners, welcoming you to your Sunday morning, early morning session, every Sunday specifically, here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And this is my Sunday morning take specifically, where you've been my company since 5 a.m. up and until 7 a.m. And as we always do here on my Sunday morning take, dear listeners, we take a look at everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between, in order to try and understand some of the greater developments, machinations, as well as also how the world actually works in our particular discussions on the Sunday morning sessions. Now, yes, you heard the sounds there of Jamata Choir with the song Automaton. Before that was the sounds of Jungle with the song Cause Your Mind. And ultimately, that's ultimately how we introduce you on a mellow note into this morning's particular programming. Now, just before we obviously start off in full earnest, do remember that you can listen to us on the Eagle FM application, which is free to download, dear listeners, on both the Google and the Apple platforms specifically, depending obviously on which particular platform you use or you are brand loyal to. And it's a free download. Do remember to just open it up and listen to your favorite programming as we always go through the course of every day's programming schedule here on your number one talk radio station, that is Eagle FM. And obviously, also do remember, I know it's a little bit early, I mean, I know, but tomorrow, hey, giving you a sneak peek, is the Villager ePaper platform's Monday release once again for the new week. And always, if you're part of our subscription process, do look forward to that particular edition. Look forward to every edition, not just the Mondays. Please, guys, we have editions every Monday, Friday, Wednesday, and Friday. So look forward to every edition. Alternatively, do remember that do consult us or our particular sort of like frequency map that we've got on our social media as well. And that is if you're trying to still discover the frequencies in the various towns, to consult that map on our social media, or alternatively stream us through the Eagle FM website, which is just Google search Eagle FM, click on it, should say Eagle FM Namibia. Click on it and remember to enable the big audio or play button that you would encounter. Doesn't matter which particular platform you're on, either a tablet or a smartphone or on a laptop. Doesn't matter. You can still listen to your favorite programming every day, every morning in that regard. For this morning's particular discussion, dear listeners, as we obviously kick off the My Sunday Morning Take session here on this somewhat chilly, somewhat cool and somewhat not rain-induced Sunday morning session coming from the capital. Oh, wow. This has actually been a subject matter that I've had sort of like the privilege to read the entire week, and it actually has sort of like stoked my fascination about it. And it's actually about, it is greatly history-induced, just to let you know, guys. And the important thing is actually it is Namibia-centric or Namibia-focused or Namibia-based even, because it is primarily, the whole thing is technically based here in Namibia. And it actually takes us, you know, sort of like on that particular, I don't want to say a simulation of some of the particular adventure stories that you would have read, would have watched. Sometimes some of you would have obviously played, for those of you that were fans of the Drake series. If you don't know who Drake is, not the rapper Drake. There's a PlayStation game series by the known as, I almost said Thick as Thieves. Is it Thick as Thieves? No, it's not Thick as Thieves. That the particular protagonist, his name is Drake in the series, actually goes around and literally looks at the un I realize now what the game's name is. The character's name in the game is obviously Nathan Drake, and the series is known as Uncharted. Now, Uncharted, obviously, just to give you a small tangent, Uncharted is a PlayStation remake of the Eidos flag-bearing game that ultimately, you know, brought this history and adventure and, you know, treasure hunting all together, known as Tomb Raider, where you had to play the iconic character of Lara Croft. And I'll tell you this, there's a huge fan base of the Lara Croft series of games before the movies were made, the movies that had Angelina Jolie in it. I personally did not want Angelina Jolie to be the iconic character because her features somehow did not speak to the character in itself. And obviously, if you do know, you know, Hollywood in the 2000s was, you know, they over-sexualized things, you know, that they made things more of the aesthetics rather of the content and the subject matter. And it sometimes when you look back at it, you also sit and cringe a little bit going like, did I really fall for this particular, you know, basic marketing gimmick, which is not supposed to be there, but you know what? It was there nonetheless. And yeah, there we go. So our discussion for today actually gives us a sort of like a, almost like a real life linkage to something akin to an Uncharted game or even a Tomb Raider game. Or even, giving insights into the movies, obviously, that have also existed. For example, if you've ever watched all the Indiana Jones movies up until the, not the last one that came out in last year, or in 2023, I think. I'm talking about the one that came out way earlier, that had Shia LaBeouf in it. If you looked at all those particular, Indiana Jones movies, well, the first three are the best, actually. Indiana Jones and the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, I think, and Indiana Jones and the, or is it just Indiana Jones, the first one? But anyway, those particular three obviously set the scene and they get us going. They get you going. They put you in the adventure drive set of, you know, of puzzles, knowing your history and intricacies. Well, actually, there's another TV series. There's another, you know, fictional series that also has, you know, caught my attention. Its name is actually National Treasure, the one that starred Nicolas Cage, the movies. Awesome stuff. Wonderful to watch. And obviously, it takes you on that whole historical discussion and the likes. So, we actually have something not similar on our hands today, but actually can potentially put you in the same particular sort of like setting of being excited about this particular development, which can potentially take you almost 500 years back. Well, it actually does take you 500 years back, and it sets the particular scene for you in terms of understanding the historical reference and the historical impact and historical connection that Namibia actually has to this particular event and maritime trade of the 16th century. Now, I'll be honest, dear listeners, I'm actually just going to shout it out. Our particular discussion centers around the Bom Jesus. If you don't know your Portuguese or you don't have a basic grasp of Portuguese like Dwight, the Bom Jesus actually means the Good Jesus, or Good Jesus, as the particular name highlights. Now, the Bom Jesus, if you have never heard of this particular ship, is actually a shipwreck that was discovered in 2008. Guess where? In the vicinity of Oranjemund. And it's on Namibia side. It's literally on Namibia side. And that the Bom Jesus, dear listeners, has in the past 2 weeks actually made a boatload, and yes, I am using that particular pun for our discussion. It has made a boatload of internet rounds in this past 2 weeks. Now, just to set the particular scene, former Deputy Minister of Education last year, that is the Deputy Minister Faustina Kelly of Education, she went down to an event in Oranjemund in terms of the establishment. She went to inaugurate a particular sort of like in heritage preservation and museum preservation event that was held in Oranjemund, which also saw the attendance of, I think, the local representative from the Portuguese embassy here in Namibia, the Portuguese embassy here in Namibia, regarding this particular discovery. Now, if you're going to ask me, Dwight, so between 2008 and 2024, you know, really, did the government only find, no, the government didn't only find out about it now or last year. No. It was, as I said, it was a heritage inauguration exercise, meaning at the local Oranjemund, museum, a particular sort of like, commemorative and inauguration based exercise was done regarding the find of the ship, this Bom Jesus merchant ship. So why, you're going to ask me, so why are they doing an inauguration about this? Well, because the thing is, if you're working in archaeology, if you're an archaeologist, let me rephrase that. If you understand how archaeology works, it takes a very long time, and that they have to incorporate a lot of particular scientific methods of ensuring that the manner in which they found or discovered the shipwreck, that they can successfully excavate it and successfully preserve it, what is left of it, in order to display it. So, if you've never seen a preservation of a ship before, which is made out of wood, there is a specific replica of a Swedish naval ship in Sweden, in Stockholm, or is it in Denmark, in Copenhagen, one of the two countries. Literally, they preserved a replica of the ship, a full life-sized replica of the ship, of this particular naval ship. And that is primarily on display, even till today. You'll find that ship there. Now, if you guys don't know what I'm talking about, the United States also has a similar thing, specifically at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, where obviously they've got replicas, they've got decommissioned military ships just sitting there in the bay of Pearl Harbor, specifically just anchored there. And obviously it gets serviced and everything, because you obviously know that the rust impacts metal, specifically for battleships. And that the preserved remains of the sunken military ships in the bay of Pearl Harbor are still there. If you have ever seen satellite photos of that particular exercise, you will see the particular United States ships that were sunk by the Japanese, that were anchored in the bay of Pearl Harbor. You can see the outline of the ship literally from a satellite or from an aerial photo. You can see it literally on the seabed of the bay. Now, our discussion highlights this particular important development. However, I will indicate to you a disclaimer at the start of our discussion right now before we get into the talk, into the meat and the bones for this particular session. So what you need to know, dear listeners, is if you go look it up on Wikipedia about the Bom Jesus, you will read a lot of particular details up to a certain particular point in terms of who really owns the shipwreck. Now, here's where things get interesting. On the Wikipedia entry about the Bom Jesus, The last particular segment, just before you get to the references or the, you know, the references section that, you know, feeds into the Wikipedia entry and article, it says there that Namibia is unwilling to hand over the remains of the shipwreck to Portugal, and that Namibia supposedly has not made any, has not provided any clarifying, indicator on when or how they will return the wreckage and its cargo to the Portuguese state. So let's set the scene. Who really owns a shipwreck or specifically such shipwrecks? So when a shipwreck is discovered in another country, let's say Namibia, has a particular shipwreck scenario in Brazil. Doesn't matter. Let's just say a ship, 300 years ago got shipwrecked and it got stranded and beached in Brazil. The shipwreck would belong to Brazil. 300 years later on, if it's discovered on that beach in Brazil, it would belong to Brazil. That is if the shipwreck was a privately owned vessel. However, if the shipwreck was a identified and recorded piece of government property, meaning it was a government ship, it was owned by a government, meaning they called it, the term they use is a national ship of that scenario, that they highlighted. Or it was owned by a state. That country who owned it originally has rights to repatriating it, laying claim of it, and thus repatriating and moving its entire remains back to its home nation. However, from what I indicated to you, what the Wikipedia entry highlights in terms of, you know, clarity in terms of who owns and the shipwreck and so forth, literally at that event of last year of 2024, back in August last year, the Portuguese embassy, and this is on their website, stated clearly that they have given Namibia ownership of this particular significant archaeological find, and that this particular shipwreck itself and its cargo, and its cargo is now the ownership of the Namibian state. So we own it now. They've handed it over to us. They've given it to us. Now you're going to ask me, Dwight, what's actually, you know, happening here? Well, to set the timeline in terms of setting the particular scene, a dedicated, heritage room had been established at the Oranjemund Museum, known as the Jasper House Museum in Oranjemund, last year, 20 August. And it's at this particular event that Portugal told Namibia, you guys can have full ownership of the wreck and the particular cargo assigned to it. Now, you're going to ask me, Dwight, why do you keep referencing the cargo? Well, it's because the cargo is actually consists of precious metals. Very precious metals. The cargo, it consists of very precious metals, in that regard. Now, I'm not highlighting to you now to go on an adventure series, but at least you could be able to go and view the particular, museum in Oranjemund, and ultimately to get a grasp or a grip in terms of understanding, you know, what the scale of this particular shipwreck looked like. Now, the Bom Jesus, if we look at the Bom Jesus in earnest, the Bom Jesus has been, up until 2008, has been lost for 500 years. If you just did the basic math in terms of the time frame between 2008 and what was the year, 1533, when it left, Lisbon, the port of Lisbon, it's 475 years back then. But if, you know, primarily still with the discussion of this, verses 1553, it's 492 years, so it's technically 500 years old now. Technically. Now, we'll quickly be stepping into a short musical break, dear listeners, and after the musical break, we'll be coming back and heading into who the Bom Jesus was and what cargo it actually carried. And no, there is no Nathan Drake Uncharted discussion going on, and neither is there any particular, you know, Lara Croft Tomb Raider discussion, nor an Indiana Jones aspect to be highlighted here. However, we're staying on the archaeological evidence, which is history-based, and ultimately, we're staying on the discussions in terms of what the Bom Jesus actually had to do. And on that note, we'll be back right after this musical break, with the rest of our discussion here on your number one talk radio station, and this is my Sunday Morning Take.
Oh,
And welcoming you back there with the sounds of Michael Jackson, obviously, with you want to be starting something. Leaving us with that iconic particular sort of like last segment there going like, Mama Se, Mama Sa, Mama Kusa, you know. If you ever heard that particular, if you ever heard that particular rhyme or that particular lyric, do know it comes from this particular track from Michael Jackson itself. So, where we left off ultimately brings us just before the top of the hour at 6 a.m. After the extended musical break that we had there in terms of just getting into our next particular chapter and subject matter and also analyzing primarily the cargo itself. So, the Bomb Jesus, if you did not know, that's the full name. And if you only woke up, that's the particular subject matter we're having a look at. The Bomb Jesus specifically was a Portuguese now, or Indiaman is the particular classification or class of ship that it was, that set sail from Lisbon, Portugal on the 7th of March, which was a Friday, 1533. Now, an Indiaman, dear listeners, is actually a merchant ship that operated under a charter or a license for European trading companies, which traded with the East Indies. If you don't know where the East Indies were, it's India, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and the other parts of Southeast Asia specifically. Southeast Asia, like Indonesia, the Philippines, and Malaysia, for that matter. And this particular kind of classification of ship operated between the 17th and 19th centuries, and the term was commonly used to refer to vessels that belonged to the British, the Dutch, the French, the Danish, and the Swedish. Now, a nau, or Portuguese nau, is actually a carack, which is a 3- or 4-masted ocean-going sailing ship that was developed in the 14th to the 15th centuries in Europe, which actually falls within the timeline of identifying the kind of architecture that was used for the specific trade ship that the Bom Jesus was. Now, most notably, these ships were used in Portugal by the Portuguese and the Spanish, and they evolved from the single-masted cog. The carack was first used for European trade from the Mediterranean to the Baltic, and quickly found its use obviously being deployed in other particular aspects around the world, specifically to navigate around the southernmost tip of Africa, which is the Cape of Good Hope, and ultimately into the Indian Ocean. The fate of the Bom Jesus was only revealed and discovered, literally discovered, in 2008 when the remains of the ship were discovered during a diamond mining operations that were ongoing on the coast of Namibia near the town of Oranjemund. So, today the Bom Jesus is the oldest known and most valuable shipwreck to be ever discovered off the western coast of sub-Saharan Africa, which also gives you an indicator specifically for how early the Portuguese were actually sailing past the shorelines of Namibia, heading around the southernmost tip of Africa to get into the Indian Ocean. Obviously, the origins of the Bom Jesus was that it was a Portuguese trading ship, a trading vessel that was constructed in the early 1500s during a period of intensive expansion by the Portuguese Empire under their king, Manuel I of Portugal. Now, Manuel I, and we're not talking about Henry the Navigator here, which is supposedly the most famous Portuguese nobleman. Henry the Navigator was actually a prince. Manuel I was also known as Manuel the Fortunate, and he was the king of Portugal from 1495 to 1521. And he was a member of the House of Aviz, and Manuel was the Duke of Beja, and Viseu prior to succeeding his cousin John II of Portugal as the King of Portugal. Now, Manuel actually ruled over a particular period in Portuguese history that ultimately saw Portugal participate in what was the very first sort of like expansionist activity taking place between Spain and Portugal at that stage. If you guys don't know about your basic history, specifically from the world of history in terms of how we were discovered in inverted or quoted, you know, air quotes or, you know, quotation marks, was primarily that all of them were looking for the passage or the ship, the maritime route to India. Because after everyone had heard about Marco Polo, and Marco Polo did exist, dear listeners, he's not a fictional character. Marco Polo did exist. But here's the thing that Marco Polo did. Marco Polo is literally the sort of like the Western, if I can call him sort of like promoter of the Silk Road. Marco Polo went onto the Silk Road and he went to Asia. He literally met Kublai Khan. Kublai Khan, he met Kublai Khan, who is the descendant of the great Genghis Khan. Genghis, but his name is actually Genghis, or Genghis Khan, who obviously ruled from Mongolia all the way up until just in front of modern day Italy. That's how far the Mongols, you know, went and conquered. And you find the surname Khan, in Pakistan, in Germany, in other parts of, you know, here in the middle of Middle Asia, Middle Europe or Central Europe or Eastern Europe. You find that surname Khan extensively, as obviously, if you did not know, Genghis Khan left a family member in every territory that he actually conquered. So it could be a far-off cousin, a relative, a brother, a sister that married somewhere or some stuff like that, or a son or had children somewhere along the way. He left a child somewhere. But Kublai Khan was emperor of China at that stage when Marco Polo met Kublai Khan. Just so that you know, Marco Polo met Kublai Khan. Now, as we're obviously sitting here in terms of, you know, crossing the T's and dotting the I's in terms of this particular discussion, where I left off with Manuel the First was literally that Manuel ruled over a period of intensive expansion of the Portuguese Empire owing to the numerous Portuguese discoveries that were made during his reign. Now, his sponsorship of Vasco da Gama led to the Portuguese discovery of the sea route to India in 1498. They were there very early, guys. Resulting in the creation of the Portuguese India Armadas. The Portuguese India Armadas, dear listeners, were the fleets of ships that were funded by the Crown of Portugal and dispatched on an annual basis from Portugal to India. And the principal destination was Goa, and previously Cochin. And these particular armadas were meant to go and trade. So it's literally, if you imagine the trade today, imagine the Ministry of Trade, which is now the Ministry of International Relations and Trade, dispatches literally, okay, obviously they would have financing, let's say, from the Ministry of Finance, and they would dispatch a fleet of ships, trade ships, that would sail, for example, let's say they would sail to Brazil, which is right across from us, and then they would, and whatever they've got there, which would be money and goods, they would show up at a Brazilian port, and the Brazilian vendors would do the same. They would then put their goods on display at the same port. That's why ports are strategic, dear listeners, for trade. And the activity of buying and selling takes place right there. And this is how back then trade used to happen. That's how trade used to happen. And this is obviously as Portugal was trying to monopolize the spice trade, because remember, there were very few spices that the Europeans could get in the Mediterranean Ocean, because there were only certain particular spices that they could get there, and predominantly they only had olive oil. If you don't know how important olive oil also was in this particular trade of goods back then, olive oil was literally, you know, one of the sort of like most traded products in the Mediterranean zone. However, the Arabs and the Middle Eastern particular civilizations, they had a specific, if I can call it a trump card, they had a specific trump card in the world of trade, which the Europeans for a very long time could not access. The Arabs obviously had their particular overland trade routes, which were known as the caravans, or actually they were the manifestation, they were manifested in the forms of camel caravans. So what is a camel caravan? A camel caravan, if you know what a caravan technically is, or a motorcade even, it's literally it's a bunch of traders that have got camels, but a whole range of camels. And because obviously that part of the Middle East is predominantly dry, arid, and very desert-like, people, the traders back then used these particular camels and camel caravans to traverse over these vast amounts of deserts, specifically over Saudi Arabia, modern day Saudi Arabia, as well as also modern day Iraq, specifically modern day Iraq, because the two largest desert areas in the Middle East is Saudi Arabia and Iraq. Now, don't add North Africa as yet. Don't add them yet. Primarily because the destination was India. The destination was always India. Much of the trade back then, when Manuel I and when the Bom Jesus obviously existed, was to get to India. Now, if you don't know why India is so important, dear listeners, could just go and look at all the spices that India still produce and sell. You find them in your everyday curries even till today. The Europeans did not know where the Arab traders or the Arab civilizations got much of their spice supply. And I just told you it's because the Arab civilizations and empires specifically had access through Iraq, through Iran, specifically into India, through Afghanistan. Because remember, on the other side of Iran is Afghanistan. And Afghanistan borders onto Pakistan, and Pakistan onto India. And literally, you can already see how the particular channel would flow in terms of accessibility from the Middle East. Now, the Great Expansion obviously also led to the colonization, under which Manuel also began the colonization of the Americas and also started off Portuguese India. If you don't know what Portuguese India also was, it was literally that port city of Goa, which still exists with that name till today. The name of Goa, the port, the city of Goa. Now, Manuel also established something by the name of Casa da India, which is a royal institution that managed Portugal's monopolies and its imperial expansion. He also financed numerous famed Portuguese navigators, which included Pedro Álvares Cabral, who discovered Brazil, Afonso de Albuquerque. Yes, if you wonder why that surname sounds so familiar, Albuquerque is literally a town or a specific geographic location in the United States. It was actually a Portuguese surname. Afonso de Albuquerque, who established the Portuguese hegemony in the Indian Ocean, just amongst a few other particular Portuguese explorers. getting back to our discussion specifically of the Bom Jesus, was that while little was known about the story of the Bom Jesus itself, is that literally it is speculated that the ship was part of a class of naval vessels that were larger, more efficient, and were more durable than the previous Portuguese and Spanish vessels in order to facilitate the longer distance expeditions that were carried out by the Portuguese during this particular time frame of when Manuel I of Portugal became, you know, came into power. Now, based on the contents of the shipwreck specifically, which included an array of luxury items and currencies, the archaeologist, which is still here in Namibia, because I've been trying to find a number of this guy, Dieter Nolli and other scholars believe that the ship was on course for Western India from its home port of Lisbon, Portugal, around the particular southern tip of Africa. Now, it was back then, as mentioned, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, it was a common route for similar Portuguese now, which is the merchant ships. It was a similar route whereby Portuguese now, during this time, had to carry the same cargo. These nows commonly sailed between Portugal, China, India, and Japan, and often carried valuable and exotic cargo such as gold, copper, spices, ivory, weaponry, and silks to and from these markets. Now, I'll share with you something right now, dear listeners, in terms of what was also part of the cargo. There was, in one of the particular reports that I discovered here online, and the one that I want actually is actually behind a paywall, so I'll still try and find it, because in that specific publication, its name is Maritime Archaeology, or I can't believe I forgot the name already, but it's either known as Maritime Archaeology or the Archaeology of Maritime Vessels or something like that. And it's the Journal of Maritime Archaeology. Oh my goodness. The Journal of Maritime Archaeology, Volume 5, edition is 2010. They mentioned in that particular book. Now, I couldn't read. I have a small excerpt from it, but trying to get to the full ship, what you call it, sort of like the full analysis about the ship itself. And this is on, it's printed by Springer, the publishing company Springer. So it's known as the Journal of Maritime Archaeology, and this is volume 5 on pages 37 to 55 in this edition of 2010. They literally speak about this particular shipwreck, the Bom Jesus, in this book. I would love to buy it, but obviously it's in euro, so it's someone, you know, if you can obviously see how intellectual property and is very essential. So what they noted here specifically in the research that they also had to do around the shipwreck is that routine sand dredging for alluvial diamonds at Oranjemund on the southern coast of Namibia exposed remnants of a long forgotten Portuguese merchant ship believed to have wrecked in the 1530s. Now, the rescue excavations yielded over 40 tons of cargo, consisting of thousands of gold and silver coins, tons of copper and lead ingots, and large quantities of ivory, together with food refuse, part of personal possessions, and the superstructure of the ship. Now, the particular paper that is contained within this journal discusses the cargo from the shipwreck. The varying provenances show that the overland inter and intra-regional networks fed into the maritime trade between Europe and the Indian subcontinent. As such, the wreck is a lens through which people can view what was happening on the seas as well as on land, and finally, for humanity obviously, to consider wider issues that were raised by the discovery relating to the protection and management of such material wherever it may be found in future. On that particular subject note, dear listeners, this is ultimately how the Bom Jesus specifically becomes part of Namibia's particular heritage profile. heritage and cultural profile. And it's a significant find in the aspect in terms of its locality. Now, on the particular map that I have in front of me, which is basically a map that's contained within the Wikipedia entry itself, the Bom Jesus is almost on the Orange River mouth. The discovery itself, the coordinates for the discovery is literally on, it's almost on the river mouth of the Orange River. So naturally, if some of you were thinking about, you know, going there and doing a little bit of becoming a little bit of a Dora Explorer, an amateur Dora the Explorer, even though the cartoon character Dora the Explorer is actually an amateur, if you look at her, you know, profession itself. But if some of you decided, you know, to be funny, you would never be able to get into that site. Never. Never be able to get into that site. First and foremost, is besides obviously the protection of the territory around the site itself, which is obviously within the particular diamond mining zones of the country, stretching obviously from the river mouth up to the town of Ludritz, and then from there you still had a little bit around Ludritz as well. If you don't know about the Sperrgebied, which is also known as the forgotten, no, not the forgotten, the forbidden zone, just to let you know, you would never be able to get in there as a casual tourist. You never. The second scenario ultimately also about this is literally also the valuable possessions or cargo of the Bom Jesus. Not the ivory. Rather, those of a metallic substance. The copper and the gold and the silver that are contained on that wreck. Now, the reason as to why this particular find would become a very protected, a highly protected find in its own right, is primarily also back in history with what has happened to the pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx at the pyramids of Giza. Is I've watched so many particular discussions, which whether they be podcast discussions or documentaries itself, about how grave robbers, treasure hunters, adventure seekers had damaged historical sites, in most cases beyond repair or beyond restoration, in some cases as a level of annoyance that actually sort of like defaces the particular installation itself. On such epic levels that you also get to ask the question in terms of why would you do this? Why would you do this? I would understand someone, you know, doing something to a mountain, because a mountain is a natural installation. But something of cultural relevance, for example, going to a site that is protected, like the Waterberg site, which is also one of the particular subject matters in the Namibian context. The Waterberg Mountain, let me just use its Afrikaans name. The Waterberg Mountain, which is technically, using the word mountain twice, berg and mountain, as well as also Shark Island in that regard. Yes, yes, dear listeners. You have to view them in the particular context, because if you now had to go to Dachau or Auschwitz, and I'm using these particular examples in Poland and, both of them are in Poland. There are tour groups that obviously go into these particular historical sites. There are tour groups that go into these sites, but the tour groups don't sleep overnight, use ablution facilities overnight, and stay there. Not like the particular sort of like questionable aspect in terms of how you preserve and ultimately look after a piece of history, for example, like what is being done in Namibia. In Namibia, these particular sites are literally camping sites, tourist destinations. I don't know what is immersive about letting people stay in a death camp or in a camp where people literally died, or on a particular historical site where people literally were slaughtered in combat. Well, the question of combat is questionable. You can put a big question mark on the notion of combat in the Waterberg incident that obviously started the whole particular Namibia's genocide history, or the subject matter or the chapter on Namibia's genocide history. Because if you don't know what the Waterberg incident technically was, it was a mass slaughter because there were women and children in there. It's akin to what General Custer committed at the Battle of Little Big Horn. I think against one of the particular major Native American groups back then. And you get to ask the particular question, why don't we have more protections around some particular groups in Namibia in terms of their particular histories that they've experienced in the time frame, obviously, of history, or how Namibian history has unfolded. Now, rolling back the years, and well, not rolling back the years, but rolling back our conversation to the point of the Bom Jesus discussion, is one where you've got to look in terms of what I just outlined in terms of accessibility. So the accessibility component, for example, a cultural and a heritage site like Waterberg, which was technically a killing zone, technically should never have been converted into a campsite or some sort of a lodging. I know people personally that have gone and visited the particular site and they've come back and said there's a weird vibe about that particular place. Same too with Shark Island. Not of people that have gone there, but the people that have gone there literally who are the descendants of people who were or who passed away or who were contained and kept at that particular concentration camp at Shark Island, is obviously a particular, historical reference. The same too also, for example, here where the school, Winterguy School, stands. If you did not know, dear listeners, that was also where one of the concentration camps here in Windhoek were. And literally where the head offices of Transnamib stand, that whole low-lying flat area there in Windhoek Central, close to the central police, right next to the central police station, was also one of the revered concentration camps that the colonial German forces had right there in Windhoek. So it's where modern day, where Transnamib's head office is, and here where Windhoek High School stands. And obviously, if you know, those were two installations, were something that the South African authorities had installed when they came in, got control of Namibia in 1918. Now, in the discussion specifically of the shipwreck and its particular importance, just before the ad break creeps up on us, was that the shipwreck itself, it is speculated the Bom Jesus, in terms of its fate, what happened to it and how did it get there, is that the Bom Jesus, yes, in the question of how did it get there, it did sail past there, or its aim was to sail past, obviously to sail past onto whichever direct destination it was meant to go to. Now, it is speculated that the Bom Jesus sank when it was pulled too closely to the shoreline of Namibia in a storm that occurred off the coast of the country at that time. So we're talking about in the 1530s. Now, this ultimately is the speculation that specifically speculated as well, is that this particular storm literally beached the ship. The ship got stuck on the beach. It caused the ship's hull to collide with rock and to lean over, ultimately capsizing the vessel. The hypothesis that exists is, and that which is also supported by the fact that the coin chest from the captain's quarters was found at the bottom of the ocean off the coast, which is the likely, sort of like a likely conclusion that the researchers have reached, in terms of that the chest fell out of the hull as it was breached by the initial collision. Now, as the Bom Jesus moved towards the shore, the superstructure and the hull likely broke apart and scattered the ship and its contents along the coastline. Now, these were later accidentally scattered further during construction of large sand-retaining walls around the site. The condition that the ship was found in suggests that the storm that caused the shipwreck was especially violent, and although an absence of human remains, besides a few scattered bone fragments, in the site suggests that most of the crew on board survived the wreck or potentially died at sea. So how was the Bom Jesus discovered? Until 2017, the mining town of Oranjemund in the Atlantic coast, or on our particular coastline back then, was ultimately run by Namdeb. We all know this. Up until 2017, the town was owned and run by Namdeb. Now, this company is obviously a joint venture between the Namibian government and the diamond mining company, De Beers. And on 1 April 2008, dear listeners, a collection or a bunch of mining employees discovered a collection of copper ingots and remnants of an elephant ivory while excavating on an inshore area that was licensed to De Beers. Now, upon further inspection, the archaeologist Dieter Nolli, who's a contractor of the De Beers company, concluded that the shipwreck was of ancient origin and enlisted the help of a maritime archaeologist, Bruno Wertz of the South African Institute of Maritime Archaeology. Now, this particular Bruno Wertz guy has got multiple entries in research, archaeological research, that he has submitted in terms of international journals around the world. They are still, in some cases, they're pretty much hidden, because every time, in preparation for this particular discussion this morning, when I've tried to access the documents to read it, in terms of getting to the research documents, they just give you a small snippet, like just the abstract. And usually an abstract is the last thing that's written when you have concluded your research report, technically. Because the abstract is based upon what you've said. So the abstract is like an executive summary. It's based upon what you've said or what you will say. When you obviously read it, it's obviously first, because it's an introduction, which summarizes what you're going to say in the rest of the document. But the rest of the document had to be written first before you could write that introduction. Just to let you know, guys, that's ultimately in the world of academics how it goes. You first have to compile all your chapters before you can write the executive summary, or you can write your abstract, so as to not go and say something else in there and something else is being said in the rest of the body of the document. That's how it ultimately has to go. Now, the particular involvement of SIMA, not a woman, please, guys. That's the organization's name, of Southern African Institute of Maritime Archaeology. The particular guy that works there, Bruno Wertz, as I mentioned, has submitted multiple works, multiple research reports, under SIMA's particular involvement, because he obviously represents SIMA. But the indication has been, because in recent weeks, the discussion around the archaeological work around the Bom Jesus has once again, in the past 2 weeks, made the rounds around Africa, or not Africa, in the world, on the internet specifically. So if you were to Google search the Bom Jesus right now, you would find recently written articles between the 1st of January this year and up to now. If you just Google search Bom Jesus, that's all. You will find recently written articles internationally on websites that were written in the last 2 weeks around the discussion. Now, it is supposedly based off a video that resurfaced once again, a YouTube particular interview, wherein Wertz and Nolli, that's now Dieter Nolli and Bruno Wertz, both of them were interviewed in this particular discussion. However, we're still on the discovery of the particular shipwreck and ultimately what it looked like. So in the initial conditions of what the Bom Jesus was found within, this is the next particular important factor to highlight. So upon its initial discovery, the remains of the ship were actually scattered in three large sections running along the coast of the country. Now, according to one of the archaeologists that worked on the site, Francisco Alves, now Francisco Alves is actually the Portuguese archaeologists that were brought in by the Portuguese government. So when the discovery was made, firstly, Namdeb obviously had to contact other archaeologists. And from there, government to government, Namibia had to inform the Portuguese about this particular discovery as well. And the Portuguese also sent their experts. Now remember, Namibia does not own maritime records of Portuguese or European ships. That's what the Europeans own. For example, let me give you an indication. About two years back, I was scrolling on X. That's Twitter, obviously. Scrolling on X, and I came across one specific account who highlighted that before it released these particular images of old, ancient navigation maps or maps that were generated by the first European explorers who were now obviously trying to, you know, to chart what does the world look like. Because if you ever wondered how a map is generated, those first explorers needed to have a cartographer and a pilot on their ships. So you had a ship's captain, you had a pilot, and you had a cartographer. Now, what does a cartographer do? A cartographer is someone that literally traces, they record every small nook and cranny of a coastline to go and draw on a map. But before we continue, guys, we're quickly going to step into a short ad break and we'll come back right after that.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHB on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Instead you live stealing the grass. Oh, quiet up in here. staring in the mirror, watching as the walls are closing in. The shadow of a figure, trying to make the best of the state that I am in. I guess I could do with the friends I've been pushing away. But I'm destined to suffer until I discover the reasons I'm afraid. God knows I try. It might not be good enough, but it's all I have to give. This is all I have to give. You might be right sometimes. I never open up, but it's all I have to give. This is all I have to give. Staring in the mirror, picturing the face of a younger man. He buries it away, 'cause he's gotta try and cope in a way he understands. Be there for your brother and strong for your mother again, 'cause he's too young to get it, and she'll get upset if she knows you feel the pain. God knows I try. It might not be good enough, but it's all I have to give. This is all I have to give. You might be right sometimes. I'm too scared to open up, but it's all I have to give. This is all I have to give to you. I tell myself there's nothing left to lose. I don't know why I'm hiding from the truth. Watching as the walls are closing in. But God knows I try. Might not be good enough, but it's all I have to give. This is all I have to give. You might be right sometimes. I'm too scared to open up, but it's all I give. This is all I have to give to you, to you. This is all I have to give. So
coming back there from the sounds of the Hurts with the song All I Have to Give. And primarily as we get to the last 20 minutes here on with my Sunday morning take, which obviously had seen you being in my company in terms of this small archaeological and rather impactful and large discussion regarding one of Namibia's particular sort of like historical, I don't call it historical treasures. In that regard. Now, obviously I mentioned the particular contents that were found on site, in specifically around the crash site, which was a crash site in its own right. Now, the remainder of the cargo, had been discovered, like the iron ingots, the weaponry, and the fragments of the wooden hull that were found encased in lime and hard-packed sandy concretions. And while these conditions have also helped to preserve and protect the contents of the ship, this particular concretion made the identification and recovery especially difficult for the archaeologists on the site. Now, the excavation efforts ultimately has been that for about a month after the first archaeological digging and surveying had begun, one particular outlet internationally, Bloomberg, announced the discovery of the shipwreck on the internet. This brought international attention to the site and its significance, and specifically the discovery of a rare Portuguese Cruzado coin by an on-site archaeologist, Paulo Monteiro. Now, if you don't know what a Cruzado, ultimately the significance of a Cruzado is that a Portuguese Cruzado is that the real, that's the currency, was the unit of currency of Portugal and the Portuguese Empire from around 1430 until 1911. It replaced the dinero at the rate of one real is about 3.5 libras, which equals about 70 soldos, which equates to 840 dineros, and was itself replaced by the escudo at a rate of one escudo is equaled to 1,000 reis. Now, the Portuguese real itself, obviously in this particular discussion, if you had to look at it today, in 2002, is that the escudo was further replaced by the euro at a rate of 1 euro is equaled to literally 200 escudos. 1 euro is literally 200 escudos. Now, escudos were literally the monetary currency that existed back when the euro replaced the Portuguese currency in 2002. So, if you also had to primarily look at this particular discussion, this is a highly valuable piece of money. That specifically is impactful. We'll quickly take a short break, dear listeners, and come back right after this.
喜欢的山南美别，坎贝拉，欧玛卡隆加科耶，帕梅纳伊巴。 Inokara uri kwa nima yesiga endera pamwe nethimbo muyuni wa technology imonena eimbiro joe mwene kongodhi yoye yopeke pamwe na imba imba oteta pamwe oshiwana no kwanja gakaneka onjimbo moshiwana ashihe sha Namibia moka epaka imba otamu adhika ehwata jonjimbo dhoongereka dhayooloka ngashi ehangano ja Elsin omaimburiro joshiherero simaneka karunga ja katolika karoma Joshimburu sang fortier noongereka dimwe. Tudengera nena ngere wapumba omaimbiro uongereka yoe gakarega wevako koka epa ka imbako nora hetatu imwe mbarindatu tano hetatu nora hamano datu. Nenge ututumine o email ko digital@omalighty.com. Otovuruku adha oka epa ka imbako App Store noko Google Play Store. Imo nena imbagoe nena.
Coming back from that quick break there, dear listeners. So the discussion around the currency itself was that literally, it obviously means that there is much more historical reference to the particular fine itself, because it ultimately gives an indication also of some of the first particular, currencies, literally in gold and silver. That were used by these early Portuguese explorers. Now, the international publicity has placed pressure on the Namibian government to seek out external sources of archaeological and scientific assistance, given at that time the urgency of the site's particular integrity. Now, this was as a result of the large sand retaining walls around the shipwreck that protected the site from the ocean water, which were at risk of being eroded due to seasonal weather and the damage that the ship's hull had experienced. Now, as a result, a meeting was held between the Namibian government back then and the other organizations that were interested in involvement with the excavation of the site, which included the delegates of Philippe Castro and Donnie Hamilton of the Anthropology Department of Texas A&M University, and representatives of the Portuguese and Spanish governments, who agreed to terms with the Namibian government to find out the true origin of the Bom Jesus, which at that particular time was unknown. Now, after the brief deliberations, obviously, that took place, a Oranjemund statement was drafted stating that the Namibian government would allow representatives of Texas A&M Archaeology Department and the Portuguese government to collaborate in the excavation of the ship, while the Namibian government would subsidize the reconstruction of the surrounding retaining walls. Now, obviously, this is where things get interesting in terms of the particular treasure find, because now we're talking about the cataloging of the cargo. So when the identification and the analysis of the cargo of the Bom Jesus had to now start, because now you have to start cataloging what you're finding, this is where things get interesting. Now, among the over 40 tons, that's 40,000 kilograms of cargo that was retrieved from the excavation site, thousands of different artifacts were recovered and catalogued, which included cannons, which included firearms, which included swords, lead, tin, textiles, and astronomical devices. Astronomical devices has to do with navigation, you know, looking at the stars, because they had to follow the stars to navigate. However, the most bountiful discoveries of the shipwreck were the collection of 1,845 copper ingots that all weighed approximately 16 to 17 tons, over 2,000 gold and silver coins from multiple contemporary maritime powers at the time, and 105 different elephant tusks that weighed close to 2 tons collectively. The discovery was unusual in that all of the ship's contents were able to be recovered and catalogued without interference from scavengers due to the highly secure nature of the De Beers mining operations in the area. The copper ingots. So the majority of the copper ingots that were found in the shipwreck have a spherical shape and are relatively standardized in both weight and size, led the archaeologists on the site to conclude that these ingots originated mostly from the same location and smelting processes. Now, because these copper ingots were so well preserved as a result of their protection from the seawater by the hull of the ship, the archaeologists on the site were able to study an unusual trident-shaped mark on the aged metal. These particular stamped trademarks on the copper ingots were found to belong to Anton Fugger, of the Fugger family. I hope I'm saying it properly, because he technically was a German merchant, and a banker and a member of the Fugger family. And primarily that the Fugger family obviously were, prominent traders in Augsburg, Germany. If you don't know where Augsburg is literally in the, southern Germany area. It's close to, Munich, München. Yeah, the other name is München, in that scenario of southern Germany. And that these copper ingots were traced to the Fugger trading family or trading company of Augsburg in that scenario. Now, one of the interesting thing about these particular copper ingots is that the Fugger family were one of the Renaissance Europe's wealthiest companies in the world at that time. So once again, Namibia's history is once again interwoven with the commercial history of Portugal and the commercial history of a non-unified Germany, but still Germany nonetheless, because Augsburg is in modern day Germany today. Now, historical documentation surrounding the Fugger Trading Company during this particular time indicated that Lisbon and other major Portuguese centers of trade were heavily involved in commerce with the Fugger family, explaining the discovery of such a large load of these copper ingots on board. Now, the historical accounts of this particular period, as well as also the geochemical analyses of the copper ingots on board, indicated that these copper ingots were produced by Fugger Turco Company in the Slovak Ore Mountains of Slovakia. Also, another particular connection to another European country who still exists today, Slovakia. The elephant ivory is the next particular interesting find. Because of how well the shipwreck and its contents were preserved for the 500 years that it had been there, the archaeologists and the geneticists on site were able to successfully sequence the DNA from 71% of the 105 different elephant tusks that were on board by using mitochondrial and nuclear DNA analysis. If you don't know what nuclear DNA is, primarily nuclear DNA is nuclear, also known as nuclear deoxyribonucleic acid. So it has to do with certain particular compounds or certain particular compound elemental analysis that is done within fossils or certain particular fossilized finds. This is specifically that DNA is contained within each cell nucleus of eukaryotic organisms. We are also eukaryotic organisms, us humans. And it also encodes for the majority of the genome in eukaryotes with mitochondrial DNA and plastid DNA coding for the rest. So just so that you know, they could extract DNA from the tusks and ultimately analyze it. Now, the particular analysis that obviously took place because they had to use isotope analysis, is that, when they also studied the relative sizes of these tusks and also the densities of the tusks, the archaeologists concluded that these ivory tusks that were also found in the particular cargo hold were likely originated from Western African forests and from savanna elephants at the time, which also corroborated with the locations of the Portuguese ivory trading posts in Africa during the same time. Now, I have to let you know, dear listeners, if you guys remember when I did the Sunday morning take session specifically where I spoke about one of the particular countries that I actually like would love to visit on the African continent, which is Sao Tome and Principe, the island, island nation of Sao Tome and Principe, which is off the coast of Ghana and Nigeria. The Portuguese were there very early. So technically they were there before the Bom Jesus got stranded or got shipwrecked here in southern Namibia. So that meant that the same ship technically potentially stopped for a refueling mission or stopped for, you know, a resupply literally at Sao Tome and Principe. Obviously the other station that they would also have to stop at was, Cabo Verde, if you don't know. That also meant that they possibly stopped at Cabo Verde. And the other stop as you would come from Portugal would obviously have been Madeira. If you don't know where Madeira is, Madeira is literally midway point between Morocco if you fly from Morocco in the ocean, into the Atlantic, and from Portugal, it would like be in an equal, you know, scenario from both countries. Now, just that specific visualization of, you know, the discussion on, you know, the early presence of the Portuguese in the exploration activities should signal to you that the Portuguese have come here for very often and for many times. They probably would have stopped with the earlier, civilizations and groups that stayed here in Namibia, that lived here in Namibia. They would obviously have come into contact with them. Obviously. Most definitely. Now, obviously, as they highlighted that these particular genetic results also included that the ivory on board the Bom Jesus originated from around 17 different herds of elephant in the region. Now, as Portugal obviously rose to prominence, the world trading power during this particular time, they would also follow suit of other European powers and pay for Asian commodities with African ivory. Now, the establishment of a Portuguese fort at the mouth of the Dahomey Gap in Benin, which is close to Sao Tome and Principe, in 1482 suggests that ivory hunted in that region was sent to the islands of Cabo Verde and Sao Tome and Principe to be processed before being shipped to Lisbon, where it would embark on its journey to Asian markets. So it would first be harvested, sent back to Lisbon, and then from Lisbon be put on the boats, and then it would sail past Lisbon and Cape and Cabo Verde around the southern tip of Africa, heading into the Indian Ocean. The coinage is another particular interesting discussion. Remember, we mentioned that there was about 2,000 gold and silver coins on board. Of the collection of the 2,159 coins that were recovered from the Bom Jesus, a majority were Spanish excelentes. Although Portuguese, Venetian, French, and Moorish coinage was also recovered in, you know, obviously in the site. Now, Spanish excelentes, dear listeners, are obviously known as also a gold coin of the Spanish. So they were also a single excelente was actually known as a dobla castellana, or just as the dobla, or sometimes known as the gran dobla, the dobla de la banda, or the dobla cruzada, or the dobla alfonsi, and the dobla almohade. And this was primarily the name of the various Iberian gold coins between the 11th and the 16th century. And obviously, they would have the monarch's face on the coin, you know, to signal who's obviously the king or the queen at the time. And the particular discussion coming back from here is obviously you can see that the Bom Jesus was laden with foreign currency. Because they had Venetian currency, they had French, they had Moorish, and they had Portuguese, was that the presence of such a great amount of Spanish coinage on board and initially led the archaeologists to believe that the ship was actually a Spanish origin. And obviously it wasn't. But this particular hypothesis was obviously quickly abandoned after further inspection by the Portuguese archaeology crews. You know, themselves sort of like also looked at the shipwreck itself. Now they noted that the inscriptions and the designs on the Portuguese coinage portraying the emblem of John II of Portugal, helped archaeologists to date the shipwreck back to the 1530s upon its initial discovery. However, the identification of the ship was approximate, meaning it was also so-so. Because, or due specifically to the Portuguese archives of the maritime trade activity during the time, being completely destroyed in the 1755 Lisbon earthquake that had happened. Now obviously, the distribution of the coins according to O Tesouro de Bom Jesus, which was written by a Luís Felipe Thomas, noted obviously, you know, how many of these particular aspects were there or how many of these particular coins there were. So there were cruzados or cruzados of Manuel, the king at the time. There were cruzados of João the Third. There were, portuguesas of, João the Third as well. You had excelentes of Reyes Católicos. You had doblas Reyes Católicos. And you had cuadruplos Reyes Católicos. Also of the Spanish, you know, contingent of gold coins. Under the Spanish coinage, there were also Ducados de Nápoles. So Ducados de Nápoles actually means it's a gold coin that comes from the city of Naples. If you guys did not know. The Spanish also had a claim over the city of Naples, which is in southern Italy. If you don't know, now you do. And they also had Ducados of Valencia, the other port city of Spain, which still exists. There were Doblas of Valencia. There were Ducados of Catalunya, which is obviously where Barcelona is based. There were Doblas of Catalunya. And then they also had Ducados of Sicily, because it says here Sicilias. And then they had Doblas of Aragon. Not Aragon from Lord of the Rings, Aragon, Juana y Carlos, and Doblas of Catalunya, Juana y Carlos, and Doblas of Navarra. In total, the Spanish contingent of coins were actually the most, in terms of what they had and contained. The Venetian currency they had, because it was from the city of Venice. The Florentine currency they had, the florins. They had Hungarian ducats. They had from the island of Rhodes. I think it's on Malta or in Cyprus. They had also had ducats. From Morocco, they had dirhams. From, also from Morocco, they also had dobla. And from other, you know, other currencies, there was a small, very small minority mixture, specifically of the coinage that was based there. On that particular note, dear listeners, it ultimately does highlight the interesting particular discovery that obviously happened back in 2008, but it has shed some light specifically in terms of the important notion in how this discovery plays an integral part of Namibia technically participating in the global world of maritime archaeology and maritime historical, if I can call it like bookmarking of events, because just imagine to yourself how many of these particular shipwrecks potentially are there around the world, stranded somewhere, just waiting to be found. On that note, we turn to a musical break, dear listeners, and after that, it brings us to the end of this morning's discussion here on your number one talk station, which is My Sunday Morning Take here on Eagle FM.